One or two could be chosen to go back to the store by the river and replenish our supplies. But in the meanwhile, everyone ought to be well inside the tunnel by night. Now, I will make you an offer. I have got my ring and will creep down this very noon. Then, if ever, Smaug ought to be napping, and see what he's up to. Perhaps something will turn up. Every worm has his weak spot, as my father used to say, though I'm sure it was not from personal experience. Naturally, the dwarves accepted the offer eagerly. Already they had come to respect little Bilbo. Now he had become the real leader in their adventure. He had begun to have ideas and plans of his own. The elf road through the wood which the dwarves had followed on the advice of Bjorn now came to a doubtful and little-used end at the eastern edge of the forest. Only the river offered any longer a safe way from the skirts of Mirkwood in the north to the mountain-shadowed plains beyond, and the river was guarded by the Wood Elves' king. So, you see, Bilbo had come in the end by the only road that was any good. It might have been some comfort to Mr. Baggins, shivering on the barrels, if he had known that news of this had reached Gandalf far away and given him great anxiety, and that he was, in fact, finishing his other business, which does not come into this tale, and getting ready to come in search of Thorin's company. But Bilbo did not know it. All he knew was that the river seemed to go on and on and on forever, and he was hungry, and had a nasty cold in the nose, and did not like the way the mountain seemed to frown at him and threaten him as it drew ever nearer. After a while, however, the river took a more southerly course, and the mountain receded again, and at last, late in the day, the shores grew rocky. The river gathered all its wandering waters together into a deep and rapid flood, and they swept along at great speed. The sun had set when, turning with another sweep towards the east, the forest river rushed into the long lake. There it had a wide mouth with stony cliff-like gates at either side, whose feet were piled with shingles. The long lake! Bilbo had never imagined that any water that was not the sea could look so big. It was so wide that the opposite shores looked small and far. But it was so long that its northerly end, which pointed towards the mountain, could not be seen at all. Only from the map did Bilbo know that away up there, where the stars of the Wain were already twinkling, the running river came down into the lake from Dale, and with a forest river, filled with deep waters, what must once have been a great deep rocky valley. At the southern end, the doubled waters poured out again over high waterfalls and ran away hurriedly to unknown lands. In the still evening air, the noise of the falls could be heard like a distant roar. Not far from the mouth of the forest river was the strange town he heard the elves speak of in the king's cellars. It was not built on the shore, though there were a few huts and buildings there, but right out on the surface of the lake, protected from the swirl of the entering river by a promontory of rock which formed a calm bay. When midday came, he got ready for another journey down into the mountain. He didn't like it, of course, but it wasn't so bad now he knew, more or less, what was in front of him. Had he known more about dragons and their wily ways, he might have been more frightened and less hopeful of catching this one napping. The sun was shining when he started, but it was as dark as night in the tunnel. The light from the door, almost closed, soon faded as he went down. So silent was his going that smoke on a gentle wind could hardly have surpassed it, and he was inclined to feel a bit proud of himself as he drew near the lower door. There was only the very faintest glow to be seen. "Old Smaug is weary and asleep," he thought. "He can't see me, and he won't hear me. cheer up, Bilbo. He had forgotten, or had never heard about dragons' sense of smell. It is also an awkward fact that they keep half an eye open watching while they sleep, if they are suspicious. Smaug certainly looked fast asleep, almost dead and dark, with scarcely a snore more than a whiff of unseen steam, when Bilbo peeped once more from the entrance. He was just about to step out onto the floor when he caught a sudden thin and piercing ray of red from under the drooping lid of Smaug's left eye. He was only pretending to sleep. He was watching the tunnel entrance. Hurriedly Bilbo stepped back and blessed the luck of his ring. Then Smaug spoke.
"Well, thief, I smell you and I feel your air. I hear your breath. Come along, help yourself again. There is plenty and to spare."
But Bilbo was not quite so unlearned in dragon lore as all that, and if Smaug hoped to get him to come nearer so easily, he was disappointed. "No, thank you, O Smaug the Tremendous," he replied. "I did not come for presents. I only wished to have a look at you and see if you were truly as great as tales say. I did not believe them." A great bridge made of wood ran out to where, on huge piles made of forest trees, was built a busy wooden town. Not a town of elves, but of men, who still dared to dwell here under the shadow of the distant Dragon Mountain. They still throve on the trade that came up the great river from the south, and was carted past the falls to their town. But in the great days of old, when Dale in the north was rich and prosperous, they had been wealthy and powerful, and there had been fleets of boats on the waters, and some were filled with gold, and some with warriors in armour, and there had been wars and deeds which were now only a legend. The rotting piles of a greater town could still be seen along the shores when the waters sank in a drought. But men remembered little of all that, though some still sang old songs of the dwarf kings of the mountain, Thror and Thrain of the race of Durin, and of the coming of the dragon, and the fall of the lords of Dale. Some sang too that Thror and Thrain would come back one day, and gold would flow in rivers through the mountain gates, and all that land would be filled with new song and new laughter. But this pleasant legend did not much affect their daily business. As soon as the raft of barrels came in sight, boats rowed out from the piles of the town, and voices hailed the raft steerers. Then ropes were cast, and oars were pulled, and soon the raft was drawn out of the current of the forest river and towed away round the high shoulder of rock into the little bay of Lake Town. There it was moored not far from the shoreward head of the great bridge. Soon men would come up from the south and take some of the casks away, and others they would fill with goods they had brought to be taken back up the stream to the wood elves' home. In the meanwhile the barrels were left afloat, while the elves of the raft and the boatmen went to feast in Lake Town. They would have been surprised, if they could have seen what happened down by the shore, after they had gone and the shades of night had fallen. First of all, a barrel was cut loose by Bilbo and pushed to the shore and opened. Groans came from inside, and out crept a most unhappy dwarf. Wet straw was in his draggled beard. He was so sore and stiff, so bruised and buffeted, he could hardly stand or stumble through the shallow water to lie groaning on the shore. He had a famished and a savage look, like a dog that has been chained and forgotten in a kennel for a week. It was Thorin.
"Do you know?"
said the dragon, somewhat flattered, even though he did not believe a word of it.
Truly, songs and tales fall utterly short of the reality, O Smaug, the chiefest and greatest of calamities, replied Bilbo.
You have nice manners for a thief and a liar, said the dragon. You seem familiar with my name, but I don't seem to remember smelling you before. Who are you, and where do you come from, may I ask?
You may indeed. I come from under the hill, and under the hills and over the hills my paths led, and through the air I am he that walks unseen.
So I can well believe, said Smaug. But that is hardly your usual name.
I am the clue-finder, the web-cutter, the stinging fly. I was chosen for the lucky number.
Lovely titles, sneered the dragon. But lucky numbers don't always come off.
I am he that buries his friends alive and drowns them and draws them alive again from the water. I came from the end of a bag, but no bag went over me.
These don't sound so creditable, scoffed Smaug.
I am the friend of bears and the guest of eagles. I am ring-winner and luck-wearer, and I am barrel-rider, went on Bilbo, beginning to be pleased with his riddling.
That's better, said Smaug, but don't let your imagination run away with you.
This, of course, is the way to talk to dragons, if you don't want to reveal your proper name, which is wise, and don't want to infuriate them by a flat refusal, which is also very wise. No dragon can resist the fascination of riddling talk and of wasting time trying to understand it. There was a lot here which Smaug did not understand at all, though I expect you do, since you know all about Bilbo's adventures to which he was referring. But he thought he understood enough, and he chuckled in his wicked inside.
I thought so last night, he smiled to himself. Lakemen, some nasty scheme of those miserable tub-trading lakemen, or I'm a lizard. I haven't been down that way for an age and an age, but I will soon alter that. "Very well, O barrel-rider," he said aloud.
But you could only have told it by his golden chain, and by the colour of his now dirty and tattered sky-blue hood with its tarnished silver tassel. It was some time before he would be even polite to the hobbit.
"Well, are you alive or are you dead?" asked Bilbo quite crossly.
Perhaps he had forgotten that he had had at least one good meal more than the dwarves, and also the use of his arms and legs, not to speak of a greater allowance of air.
Are you still in prison, or are you free? If you want food, and if you want to go on with this silly adventure, it's yours after all and not mine, you had better slap your arms and rub your legs, and try to help me get the others out while there's a chance.
Thorin, of course, saw the sense of this, so after a few more groans he got up and helped the hobbit as well as he could. In the darkness, floundering in the cold water, they had a difficult and very nasty job finding which were the right barrels. Knocking outside and calling only discovered about 6 dwarves that could answer. They were unpacked and helped ashore, where they sat or lay muttering and moaning. They were so soaked and bruised and cramped that they could hardly yet realize their release or be properly thankful for it. Dwalin and Balin were 2 of the most unhappy, and it was no good asking them to help. Bifur and Bofur were less knocked about and drier, but they lay down and would do nothing. Feely and Keely, however, who were young for dwarves, and had also been packed more neatly with plenty of straw into smaller casks, came out more or less smiling, with only a bruise or 2 and a stiffness that soon wore off.
I hope I never smell the smell of apples again, said Feely. My tub was full of it. To smell apples everlastingly when you can scarcely move and are cold and sick with hunger is maddening. I could eat anything in the wide world now for hours on end, but not an apple.
With the willing help of Feely and Keely, Thorin and Bilbo at last discovered the remainder of the company and got them out. Poor fat Bumba was asleep or senseless. Dori, Nori, Ori, Oin and Gloin were waterlogged and seemed only half alive. They all had to be carried one by one and laid helpless on the shore.
"Well, here we are," said Thorin. "And I suppose we ought to thank our stars and Mr. Baggins. I'm sure he has a right to expect it. Maybe Beryl was your pony's name, and maybe not, though it was fat enough. You may walk unseen, but you did not walk all the way. Let me tell you, I ate 6 ponies last night. And I shall catch and eat all the others before long, in return for the excellent meal. I will give you 1 piece of advice for your good. Don't have more to do with dwarves than you can help."
"Dwarves?" said Bilbo in pretended surprise.
"Don't talk to me," said Smaug. "I know the smell and taste of dwarf. No one better. Don't tell me that I can eat a dwarf-ridden pony and not know it. You'll come to a bad end if you go with such friends, thief barrel rider. I don't mind if you go back and tell them so from me."
But he did not tell Bilbo that there was 1 smell he could not make out at all, hobbit smell. It was quite outside his experience and puzzled him mightily.
"I suppose you got a fair price for that cup last night," he went on. "Come now, did you? Nothing at all? Well, that's just like them. And I suppose they are skulking outside, and your job is to do all the dangerous work and get what you can when I'm not looking for them. And you will get a fair share. Don't you believe it? If you get off alive, you will be lucky."
Bilbo was now beginning to feel really uncomfortable. Whenever Smaug's roving eye, seeking for him in the shadows, flashed across him, he trembled, and an unaccountable desire seized hold of him to rush out and reveal himself and tell all the truth to Smaug. In fact, he was in grievous danger of coming under the dragon spell. But plucking up courage, he spoke again. "You don't know everything, O Smaug the Mighty," said he. "Not gold alone brought us hither."
"Though I wish he could have arranged a more comfortable journey. Still, all very much at your service once more, Mr. Baggins. No doubt we shall feel properly grateful when we are fed and recovered. In the meanwhile, what next?"
"I suggest Lake Town," said Bilbo. "What else is there?" "Nothing else could, of course, be suggested." So leaving the others, Thorin and Feely and Keely and the Hobbit went along the shore to the great bridge. There were guards at the head of it, but they were not keeping very careful watch, for it was so long since there had been any real need. Except for occasional squabbles about river tolls, they were friends with the wood elves. Other folk were far away, and some of the younger people in the town openly doubted the existence of any dragon in the mountain. and laughed at the greybeards and gammers who said that they had seen him flying in the sky in their young days. That being so, it is not surprising that the guards were drinking and laughing by a fire in their hut, and did not hear the noise of the unpacking of the dwarves or the footsteps of the four scouts. Their astonishment was enormous when Thorin Oakenshield stepped in through the door.
"Who are you and what do you want?" they shouted, leaping to their feet and groping for weapons. "Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror, king under the mountain," said the dwarf in a loud voice,
and he looked it, in spite of his torn clothes and draggled hood. The gold gleamed on his neck and waist. His eyes were dark and deep.
"I have come back. I wish to see the master of your town."
Then there was tremendous excitement. Some of the more foolish ran out of the hut as if they expected the mountain to go golden in the night and all the waters of the lake to turn yellow right away. The captain of the guard came forward.
"And who are these?" he asked, pointing to Feely and Keely and Bilbo. "The sons of my father's daughter," answered Thorin. "Feely and Keely of the race of Durin, and Mr. Baggins, who has travelled with us out of the west."
"If you come in peace, lay down your arms," said the captain.
"We have none," said Thorin. And it was true enough. Their knives had been taken from them by the wood elves, and the great sword Orcrist too.
Bilbo had his short sword, hidden as usual, but he said nothing about that.
"We have no need of weapons, or to turn at last to our own as spoken of old."
"Ha, ha, you admit the ass," laughed Smaug. "Why not say us 14 and be done with it, Mr. Lucky Number? I am pleased to hear that you had other business in these parts besides my gold. In that case, you may perhaps not altogether waste your time. I don't know if it has occurred to you that, even if you could steal the gold bit by bit, a matter of 100 years or so, you could not get it very far. Not much use on the mountainside. Not much use in the forest. Bless me. Had you never thought of the catch? A 14th share, I suppose, or something like it. Those were the terms, eh? But what about delivery? What about cartage? What about armed guards and tolls?"
And Smaug laughed aloud. He had a wicked and a wily heart, and he knew his guesses were not far out, though he suspected that the lake men were at the back of the plans, and that most of the plunder was meant to stop there in the town by the shore that in his young days had been called Esgaroth. You will hardly believe it, but poor Bilbo was really very taken aback. So far all his thoughts and energies had been concentrated on getting to the mountain and finding the entrance. He had never bothered to wonder how the treasure was to be removed, certainly never how any part of it that might fall to his share was to be brought back all the way to Bag End Underhill. Now a nasty suspicion began to grow in his mind. Had the dwarves forgotten this important point too, or were they laughing in their sleeves at him all the time? That is the effect that dragon talk has on the inexperienced. Bilbo, of course, ought to have been on his guard, but Smaug had rather an overwhelming personality. "I tell you," he said, in an effort to remain loyal to his friends and to keep his end up, "that gold was only an afterthought with us. We came over hill and under hill, by wave and wind, for revenge. Surely, O Smaug, the unassessably wealthy, you must realize that your success has made you some bitter enemies." Then Smaug really did laugh, a devastating sound which shook Bilbo to the floor, while far up in the tunnel the dwarves huddled together and imagined that the hobbit had come to a sudden and a nasty end.
Nor could we fight against so many. Take us to your master.
He is at feast, said the captain.
Then all the more reason for taking us to him,
burst in Feely, who was getting impatient at these solemnities.
We are worn and famished after our long road, and we have sick comrades. Now make haste, and let us have no more words, or your master may have something to say to you.
Follow me, then, said the captain, and with six men about them, he led them over the bridge, through the gates, and into the marketplace of the town. This was a wide circle of quiet water, surrounded by the tall piles on which were built the greater houses, and by long wooden quays with many steps and ladders going down to the surface of the lake. From one great hall shone many lights, and there came the sound of many voices. They passed its doors and stood blinking in the light, looking at long tables filled with folk.
I am Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror, king under the mountain. I return, cried Thorin in a loud voice from the door, before the captain could say anything.
All leapt to their feet. The master of the town sprang from his great chair, but none rose in greater surprise than the raft men of the elves who were sitting at the lower end of the hall. Pressing forward before the master's table, they cried,
These are prisoners of our king that have escaped, wandering vagabond dwarves that could not give any good account of themselves, sneaking through the woods and molesting our people.
Revenge!
He snorted, and the light of his eyes lit the hall from floor to ceiling like scarlet lightning.
Revenge! The king under the mountain is dead, and where are his kin that dare seek revenge? Geryon, lord of Dale, is dead, and I have eaten his people like a wolf among sheep. And where are his sons that dare approach me? I kill where I wish, and none dare resist. I laid low the warriors of old, and their like is not in the world today. Then I was but young and tender. Now I am old and strong, strong, strong. Thief in the shadows, he gloated. My armor is like tenfold shields. My teeth are swords. My claws, spears. The shock of my tail is a thunderbolt. My wings a hurricane, and my breath death.
I have always understood, said Bilbo in a frightened squeak, that dragons were softer underneath, especially in the region of the chest. But doubtless one so fortified has thought of that.
The dragon stopped short in his boasting.
Your information is antiquated, he snapped. I am armored above and below with iron scales and hard gems. No blade can pierce me.
I might have guessed it, said Bilbo. Truly there can nowhere be found the equal of Lord Smaug the Impenetrable. What magnificence to possess a waistcoat of fine diamonds!
Yes, it is rare and wonderful indeed, said Smaug, absurdly pleased.
He did not know that the hobbit had already caught a glimpse of his peculiar undercovering on his previous visit, and was itching for a closer view, for reasons of his own. The dragon rolled over.
Look, he said, what do you say to that?
Dazzlingly marvellous! Perfect! Flawless! Staggering! Exclaimed Bilbo aloud. But what he thought inside was, Old fool! why there is a large patch in the hollow of his left breast, as bare as a snail out of its shell.
"Is this true?"
asked the master. As a matter of fact, he thought it far more likely than the return of the king under the mountain, if any such person had ever existed.
"It is true that we were wrongfully waylaid by the elven king and imprisoned without cause as we journeyed back to our own land," answered Thorin. "But lock nor bar may hinder the homecoming spoken of old. Nor is this town in the Wood Elves' realm. I speak to the master of the town of the men of the lake, not to the raftmen of the king."
Then the master hesitated, and looked from one to the other. The elven king was very powerful in those parts, and the master wished for no enmity with him, nor did he think much of old songs, giving his mind to trade and tolls, to cargoes and gold, to which habit he owed his position. Others were of different mind, however, and quickly the matter was settled without him. The news had spread from the doors of the hall like fire through all the town. People were shouting inside the hall and outside it. The quays were thronged with hurrying feet. Some began to sing snatches of old songs concerning the return of the king under the mountain, that it was Thrall's grandson, not Thrall himself, that had come back did not bother them at all. Others took up the song, and it rolled loud and high over the lake.
"The king beneath the mountains, the king of carven stone, the lord of silver fountains, shall come into his own. His crown shall be upholden, his harp shall be restrung, his hall shall echo golden to songs of yore sung. The woods shall wave on mountains and grass beneath the sun. His wealth shall flow in fountains and the rivers golden run. The stream shall run in gladness, the lake shall shine and burn, and sorrow fail and sadness at the mountain king's return."
So they sang, or very like that, only there was a great deal more of it, and there was much shouting as well, as the music of harps and of fiddles mixed up with it. Indeed, such excitement had not been known in the town in the memory of the oldest grandfather. The wood elves themselves began to wonder greatly, and even to be afraid. They didn't know, of course, how Thorin had escaped, and they began to think their king might have made a serious mistake. As for the master, he saw there was nothing else for it but to obey the general clamour, for the moment at any rate, and to pretend to believe that Thorin was what he said. After he had seen that, Mr. Baggins' one idea was to get away. "Well, I really must not detain your magnificence any longer," he said, "or keep you from your much-needed rest. Ponies take some catching, I believe, after a long start. And so do burglars," he added as a parting shot, as he darted back and fled up the tunnel. It was an unfortunate remark, for the dragon spouted terrific flames after him, and fast though he sped up the slope, he had not gone nearly far enough to be comfortable before the ghastly head of Smaug was thrust against the opening behind. Luckily the whole head and jaws could not squeeze in, but the nostrils sent forth fire and vapour to pursue him, and he was nearly overcome, and stumbled blindly on in great pain and fear. He had been feeling rather pleased with the cleverness of his conversation with Smaug, but his mistake at the end shook him into better sense. "Never laugh at live dragons, Bilbo, you fool," he said to himself, and it became a favourite saying of his later, and passed into a proverb. "You aren't nearly through this adventure yet," he added, and that was pretty true as well. The afternoon was turning into evening, when he came out again and stumbled and fell in a faint on the doorstep. The dwarves revived him and doctored his scorches as well as they could, but it was a long time before the hair on the back of his head and his heels grew properly again. It had all been singed and frizzled right down to the skin. In the meanwhile, his friends did their best to cheer him up, and they were eager for his story, especially wanting to know why the dragon had made such an awful noise and how Bilbo had escaped. But the hobbit was worried and uncomfortable, and they had difficulty in getting anything out of him. On thinking things over, he was now regretting some of the things he had said to the dragon, and was not eager to repeat them. The old thrush was sitting on a rock nearby, with his head cocked on one side, listening to all that was said. It shows what an ill temper Bilbo was in. He picked up a stone and threw it at the thrush, which merely fluttered aside and came back. "Drat the bird," said Bilbo crossly. "I believe he's listening, and I don't like the look of him."
"Leave him alone," said Thorin. "The thrushes are good and friendly. This is a very old bird indeed, and is maybe the last left of the ancient breed that used to live about here, tamed to the hands of my father and grandfather."
So he gave up to him his own great chair, and set Feely and Keely beside him in places of honour. Even Bilbo was given a seat at the high table, and no explanation of where he came in. No songs had alluded to him, even in the obscurest way, was asked for in the general bustle. Soon afterwards, the other dwarves were brought into the town amid scenes of astonishing enthusiasm. They were all doctored and fed and housed and pampered in the most delightful and satisfactory fashion. A large house was given up to Thorin and his company. Boats and rowers were put at their service, and crowds sat outside and sang songs all day, or cheered if any dwarf showed so much as his nose. Some of the songs were old ones, but some of them were quite new, and spoke confidently of the sudden death of the dragon and of cargoes of rich presents coming down the river to Lake Town. These were inspired largely by the master, and it did not particularly please the dwarves, but in the meantime they were well contented, and they quickly grew fat and strong again. Indeed, within a week they were quite recovered, fitted out in fine cloth of their proper colours, with beards combed and trimmed, and proud steps. Thorin looked and walked as if his kingdom was already regained, and Smaug chopped up into little pieces. Then, as he had said, the dwarves' good feeling towards the little hobbit grew stronger every day. There were no more groans or grumbles. They drank his health, and they patted him on the back, and they made a great fuss of him, which was just as well, for he was not feeling particularly cheerful. He had not forgotten the look of the mountain, nor the thought of the dragon, and he had besides a shocking cold. For 3 days he sneezed and coughed, and he could not go out, and even after that his speeches at banquets were limited to,
"Thank you very much."
In the meanwhile the wood elves had gone back up the forest river with their cargoes, and there was great excitement in the king's palace. I have never heard what happened to the chief of the guards and the butler. Nothing, of course, was ever said about keys or barrels while the dwarves stayed in Lake Town, and Bilbo was careful never to become invisible. Still, I dare say, more was guessed than was known, though doubtless Mr. Baggins remained a bit of a mystery. In any case, the king knew now the dwarves' errand, or thought he did, and he said to himself, "Very well, we'll see. No treasure will come back through Mirkwood without my having something to say on the matter."
They were a long-lived and magical race, and this might even be one of those that were alive then, a couple of hundreds of years or more ago. The men of Dale used to have the trick of understanding their language, and used them for messengers to fly to the men of the lake and elsewhere.
"Well," "'He'll have news to take to Lake Town, all right, "'if that is what he's after,' said Bilbo. "'Though I don't suppose there are any people left there "'that trouble with thrush language.'
"'Why, what has happened?' cried the dwarves. "'Do get on with your tale.'
"'So Bilbo told them all he could remember, "'and he confessed that he had a nasty feeling "'that the dragon guessed too much from his riddles "'added to the camps and the ponies. "'I'm sure he knows we came from Lake Town "'and had help from there, "'and I have a horrible feeling "'that his next move may be in that direction.' "'I wish to goodness I'd never said that about Barrel Rider. "'It would make even a blind rabbit in these parts think of the lake men. "'Well, well, it can't be helped, "'and it's difficult not to slip in talking to a dragon, "'or so I've always heard,' said Balin, anxious to comfort him. "'I think you did very well, if you ask me.' "'You found out one very useful thing at any rate, "'and got home alive, "'and that's more than most can say "'who've had words with the likes of Smaug. "'It may be a mercy and a blessing yet "'to know of the bare patch in the old worm's diamond waistcoat.' "'That turned the conversation, "'and they all began discussing dragon-slaying's historical, "'dubious and mythical, and the various sorts of stabs and jabs and undercuts, and the different arts, devices, and stratagems by which they had been accomplished. The general opinion was that catching a dragon napping was not as easy as it sounded, and the attempt to stick one or prod one asleep was more likely to end in disaster than a bold frontal attack. All the while they talked, the thrush listened, till at last, when the stars began to peep forth, it silently spread its wings and flew away. And all the while they talked and the shadows lengthened, Bilbo became more and more unhappy, and his foreboding grew. At last he interrupted them. "'I'm sure we're very unsafe here,' he said, "'and I don't see the point of sitting here. "'The dragon has withered all the pleasant green, "'and anyway the night has come and it's cold.' "'But I feel it in my bones that this place will be attacked again. "'Smaug knows now how I came down to his hall, "'and you can trust him to guess where the other end of the tunnel is. "'He will break all this side of the mountain to bits, if necessary, "'to stop up our entrance, and if we're smashed with it, "'the better he will like it.'
"'You are very gloomy, Mr. Baggins,' said Thorin. "'Why has not Smaug blocked the lower end, then, if he's so eager to keep us out? "'He has not, or we should have heard him.'
I don't know, because at first he wanted to try and lure me in again, I suppose, "'and now perhaps because he's waiting till after tonight's hunt, "'or because he does not want to damage his bedroom if he can help it. "'But I wish you would not argue, but I expect they will all come to a bad end, "'and serve them right.' He, at any rate, did not believe in dwarves fighting and killing dragons like Smaug, and he strongly suspected attempted burglary or something like it, which shows he was a wise elf, and wiser than the men of the town, though not quite right, as we shall see in the end. He sent out his spies about the shores of the lake, and as far northward towards the mountains as they would go, and waited. At the end of a fortnight, Thorin began to think of departure. While the enthusiasm still lasted in the town, was the time to get help. It would not do to let everything cool down with delay. So he spoke to the master and his councillors, and said that soon he and his company must go on towards the mountain. Then, for the first time, the master was surprised and a little frightened. And he wondered if Thorin was after all really a descendant of the old kings. He had never thought that the dwarves would actually dare to approach Smaug, but believed they were frauds who would sooner or later be discovered and be turned out. He was wrong. Thorin, of course, was really the grandson of the king under the mountain, and there is no knowing what a dwarf will not dare and do, for revenge or the recovery of his own. but the master was not sorry at all to let them go. They were expensive to keep, and their arrival had turned things into a long holiday in which business was at a standstill. "Let them go and bother Smaug, and see how he welcomes them," he thought. "Certainly, O Thorin Thrain's son, Thror's son," was what he said. "You must claim your own. The hour is at hand, spoken of old. What help we can offer shall be yours, and we trust to your gratitude when your kingdom is regained." So one day, although autumn was now getting far on, and winds were cold, and leaves were falling fast, three large boats left Lake Town, laden with rowers, dwarves, Mr. Baggins, and many provisions. Horses and ponies had been sent round by circuitous paths to meet them at their appointed landing place. The master and his councillors bade them farewell from the great steps of the town hall that went down to the lake. People sang on the quays and out of windows. The white oars dipped and splashed, and off they went north up the lake on the last stage of their long journey. The only person thoroughly unhappy was Bilbo.
"Smaug will be coming out at any minute now, and our only hope is to get well in the tunnel and shut the door."
He seemed so much in earnest that the dwarves at last did as he said, though they delayed shutting the door. It seemed a desperate plan, for no one knew whether or how they could get it open again from the inside, and the thought of being shut in a place from which the only way out led through the dragon's lair was not one they liked. Also, everything seemed quite quiet, both outside and down the tunnel. So for a longish while they sat inside, not far down from the half-open door, and went on talking. The talk turned to the dragon's wicked words about the dwarves. Bilbo wished he had never heard them, or at least that he could feel quite certain that the dwarves now were absolutely honest when they declared that they had never thought at all about what would happen after the treasure had been won.
"We knew it would be a desperate venture," said Thorin, "and we know that still. And I still think that when we have won it, we'll be time enough to think what to do about it. As for your share, Mr. Baggins, I assure you we are more than grateful, and you shall choose your own 14th as soon as we have anything to divide. I'm sorry if you're worried about transport, and I admit the difficulties are great. The lands have not become less wild with the passing of time, rather the reverse. But we will do whatever we can for you, and take our share of the cost when the time comes. Believe me or not, as you like."
From that the talk turned to the great hoard itself, and to the things that Thorin and Balin remembered. They wondered if they were still lying there, unharmed in the hall below. The spears that were made for the armies of the great King Bloodorthin, long since dead. Each had a thrice-forged head, and their shafts were inlaid with cunning gold, but they were never delivered or paid for. Shields made for warriors long dead. The great golden cup of Thror, two-handed, hammered and carven with birds and flowers, whose eyes and petals were of jewels. Coats of mail gilded and silvered and impenetrable. The necklace of Gideon, Lord of Dale, made of 500 emeralds green as grass, which he gave for the arming of his eldest son, in a coat of dwarf-linked rings the like of which had never been made before, for it was wrought of pure silver to the power and strength of triple steel. But fairest of all was the great white gem, which the dwarves had found beneath the roots of the mountain, the heart of the mountain, the Arkenstone of Thrain.
"The Arkenstone, the Arkenstone," murmured Thorin in the dark, half dreaming with his chin upon his knees. "It was like a globe with a thousand facets.
It shone like silver in the firelight, like water in the sun, like snow under the stars, like rain upon the moon.
Chapter 11. On the Doorstep. In 2 days going, they rode right up the long lake and passed out into the river running. And now they could all see the lonely mountain towering grim and tall before them. The stream was strong, and they going slow. At the end of the third day, some miles up the river, they drew into the left or western bank and disembarked. Here they were joined by the horses with other provisions and necessaries, and the ponies for their own use that had been sent to meet them. They packed what they could on the ponies, and the rest was made into a store under a tent. But none of the men of the town would stay with them, even for the night, so near the shadow of the mountain. "Not at any rate until the songs have come true," said they. It was easier to believe in the dragon, and less easy to believe in Thorin, in these wild parts. Indeed, their stores had no need of any guard, for all the land was desolate and empty. So their escort left them, making off swiftly down the river and the shoreward paths, although the night was already drawing on. They spent a cold and lonely night, and their spirits fell. The next day they set out again. Balin and Bilbo rode behind, each leading another pony heavily laden beside him. The others were some way ahead, picking out a slow road, for there were no paths. They made northwest, slanting away from the river running, and drawing ever nearer and nearer to a great spur of the mountain that was flung out southwards towards them. It was a weary journey, and a quiet and stealthy one. There was no laughter or song or sound of harps, and the pride and hopes which had stirred in their hearts at the singing of old songs by the lake died away to a plodding gloom. They knew that they were drawing near to the end of their journey, and that it might be a very horrible end. The land about them grew bleak and barren, though once, as Thorin told them, it had been green and fair. There was little grass, and before long there was neither bush nor tree, and only broken and blackened stumps to speak of ones long vanished. They were come to the desolation of the dragon, and they were come at the waning of the year. They reached the skirts of the mountain, all the same, without meeting any danger or any sign of the dragon, other than the wilderness he had made about his lair. The mountain lay dark and silent before them, and even higher above them. But the enchanted desire of the hoard had fallen from Bilbo. All through their talk, he was only half listening to them. He sat nearest to the door, with one ear cocked for any beginnings of a sound without. His other was alert for echoes beyond the murmurs of the dwarves, for any whisper of a movement from far below. Darkness grew deeper, and he grew ever more uneasy. "Shut the door," he begged them. "I fear that dragon in my marrow. I like this silence far less than the uproar of last night. Shut the door before it's too late." Something in his voice gave the dwarves an uncomfortable feeling. Slowly Thorin shook off his dreams, and getting up he kicked away the stone that wedged the door. Then they thrust upon it, and it closed with a snap and a clang. No trace of a keyhole was there left on the inside. They were shut in the mountain. And not a moment too soon. They had hardly gone any distance down the tunnel when a blow smote the side of the mountain like the crash of battering rams made of forest oaks and swung by giants. The rock boomed, the walls cracked, and stones fell from the roof on their heads. What would have happened if the door had still been open, I don't like to think. They fled further down the tunnel, glad to be still alive, while behind them, outside, they heard the roar and rumble of Smaug's fury. He was breaking rocks to pieces, smashing wall and cliff with the lashings of his huge tail, till their little lofty camping ground, the scorched grass, the thrush's stone, the snail-covered walls, the narrow ledge, and all disappeared in a jumble of smithereens, and an avalanche of splintered stones fell over the cliff into the valley below. Smaug had left his lair in silent stealth, quietly soared into the air, and then floated heavy and slow in the dark like a monstrous crow down the wind towards the west of the mountain, in the hopes of catching unawares something or somebody there, and of spying the outlet to the passage which the thief had used. This was the outburst of his wrath, when he could find nobody and see nothing, even where he guessed the outlet must actually be. After he had let off his rage in this way, he felt better, and he thought in his heart that he would not be troubled again from that direction. In the meanwhile he had further vengeance to take.
"Barrel rider," he snorted, "your feet came from the waterside, and up the water you came without a doubt. I don't know your smell, but if you are not one of those men of the lake, you had their help. They shall see me and remember who is the real king under the mountain."
He rose in fire and went away south towards the running river. They made their first camp on the western side of the Great Southern Spur, which ended in a height called Ravenhill. On this there had been an old watchpost, but they dared not climb it yet. It was too exposed. Before setting out to search the western spurs of the mountain for the hidden door, on which all their hopes rested, Thorin sent out a scouting expedition to spy out the land to the south where the front gate stood. For this purpose he chose Balin and Fili and Kili, and with them went Bilbo. They marched under the grey and silent cliffs to the feet of Ravenhill. There the river, after winding a wide loop over the valley of Dale, turned from the mountain on its road to the lake, flowing swiftly and noisily. Its bank was bare and rocky, tall and steep above the stream, and gazing out from it over the narrow water, foaming and splashing among many boulders, they could see in the wide valley shadowed by the mountain's arms the grey ruins of ancient houses, towers, and walls.
"There lies all that is left of Dale," said Balin. "The mountain sides were green with woods, and all the sheltered valley rich and pleasant in the days when the bells rang in that town."
He looked both sad and grim as he said this. He had been one of Thorin's companions on the day the dragon came. They did not dare to follow the river much further towards the gate, but they went on beyond the end of the southern spur, until lying hidden behind a rock, they could look out and see the dark, cavernous opening in a great cliff wall between the arms of the mountain. Out of it the waters of the running river sprang, and out of it, too, there came a stream and a dark smoke. Nothing moved in the waste, save the vapour and the water, and every now and again a black and ominous crow. The only sound was the sound of the stony water, and every now and again the harsh croak of a bird. Balin shuddered.
"Let us return," he said. "We can do no good here, and I don't like these dark birds. They look like spies of evil."
"The dragon is still alive and in the halls under the mountain, then? Or I imagine so from the smoke," said the hobbit.
"That does not prove it," said Balin, "though I don't doubt you're right. But he might be gone away some time, or he might be lying out on the mountainside keeping watch. And still I expect smokes and steams would come out of the gates. All the halls within must be filled with his foul reek."
Chapter 13. Not at home. In the meanwhile, the dwarves sat in darkness, and utter silence fell about them. Little they ate, and little they spoke. They could not count the passing time, and they scarcely dared to move,